Episode 3, The Twilight War. A pall hung over Europe. Poland lay in ruins. The greatest powers of the continent, England, France and Germany, were at war. And yet war did not come.
The German people...
Speeches were made, mighty proclamations of defiance or vengeance, but all was quiet on the Western Front. In the great cities, tens of millions nervously wait for the guns to fire, for the bombs to drop. But for half a year, it seemed like the war might never come. Welcome to The Finest Half Hour, read by Richard Cutland, written by Jim Jager, and brought to you with the generous help of Wargaming. Each week, we'll bring you a small part of the story of the greatest conflict of the modern age, the Second World War, the war that shaped our world. The 8 months between the invasion of Poland and when fighting began in earnest in France. It was called the Phony War, the Twilight War, or by those of a more jocular nature, Sitzkrieg. It was the calm before the storm. During this time, for most in Britain and France, very little changed in their daily lives from how things had been before the war. It was the last moment where people deluded themselves into thinking that all-out conflict might be avoided, that Hitler's Germany might be fought in proxy states around the perimeter of Europe, or might collapse in and of itself. It was the last moment where people told themselves that the rise of fascism might mean anything other than a titanic struggle for the soul of Europe, that Nazism would be anything short of a nightmare, which millions of people would have to sacrifice everything to overcome. France, Belgium and the Netherlands all clung to the idea that war, if inevitable, might not be fought on their soil. In Belgium, the government wanted to avoid anything which might give Hitler a pretext to invade their small nation, so they staunchly denied French and British forces access to their country, leaving Allied troops to dig trenches and man lines that they fully planned to abandon the moment they heard that German troops were on the march, for they expected the Germans to follow their First World War plans, attack France by seizing Belgium and storming across the Belgian frontier. The French, for their part, had suffered a deep psychological wound during the First World War. Even though they won, most of the war was fought on French soil. French farmland was turned into trenches. French houses served as billets. French forests were reduced to shell craters. It was not something they ever wanted to endure again. They were looking for somewhere else, anywhere else, to fight the war. The British, meanwhile, were desperately under-mobilised. They'd avoided conscription for as long as possible and had started their rearmament efforts years later than the Third Reich. They hoped to use their sea power to strangle the German economy, perhaps stopping the conflict from truly escalating to a full-scale land war. And so the Western nations did nothing, while Hitler rested and re-equipped his army following its stunning campaign across Poland. But that didn't mean everything was peaceful during this period. Far to the east, in the bitter cold of the Arctic Circle, war was brewing. November the 13th to the 30th, 1939. A sturdy cottage stands in the middle of the snow. Two soldiers knock at the door. An old woman opens up. They explain to her that they're going to have to burn her home. The Russians are coming. The policy is scorched earth. They can't be left a single roof to sleep under. They tell her she must gather what she can. They'll be back in the morning to raise her home to the ground. As the sun rises slowly over the white fields, the soldiers return. They find the house empty. It has been immaculately cleaned. On the table are matches, petrol, and a note. When one gives a gift to Finland, one desires that it should be like new. Stalin has always eyed the Finnish border with unease. Finland had broken away from the old Tsarist Empire during the Russian Revolution, and in doing so left the Soviet Union with a nation whose territory ended a mere 20 miles from Leningrad. An army massing in Finland would be at the gates of the second largest city in Russia in mere hours. And in Stalin's paranoid mind, Finland's protestations of neutrality were all just a ruse. When the real fighting started, he convinced himself they would side with the Third Reich. So he swiftly went about making that a self-fulfilling prophecy. In early October of 1939, the Soviet Union sent the government of Finland a list of demands. They wanted the Finns to give up territory along the border, cede a group of islands in the Gulf of Finland to the Soviet Union, and to lease the Soviets an army base on the Finnish mainland that was to be garrisoned with thousands of troops. Such concessions would cripple Finland's defences and make it impossible for them to refuse any further concessions Stalin demanded. So the government said no. One voice, an old and esteemed voice, though, urged caution. It was Baron Carl Gustav Emil Mannerheim, Finland's greatest general. He had served with distinction under the Tsars in the Russo-Japanese War, become part of the Russian Imperial Guard, then in 1917, when Finland declared its independence from the newly formed Soviet Union, became the driving force that led the anti-communists to victory in the Finnish Civil War. He served as the country's first regent and helped it attain legitimacy around the world. He was 72 when the war broke out. He did not want to serve as commander-in-chief. He had seen three wars already. He did not want to see a fourth. He also knew the state of the Finnish army. They did not possess a single functioning anti-tank gun, had only a handful of modern fighter planes, used radios whose vacuum tubes had a tendency to explode in the extreme cold of northern Finland, and much of their artillery hadn't been updated since 1905. He knew, too, that his tiny nation of 3.7 million people could never stand up against the nearly 200 million people the Soviet Union had in its domain. So he urged the President and the Senate to find a different solution, to offer the Russians something to avoid a war they could never win. But it was not to be. So, when called upon, he took up the baton of command and prepared for the Soviet invasion. December the 1st till February the 15th, 1939-40, the Winter War. They walked quietly through the great dark pines, footfalls hushed by snow. The cold was so deep, air stung the lungs. He was far, far from home. He wanted food, something warm. He was 18. He'd spent his life on a farm until he was forced to join the army. He didn't know why he was fighting, or really what they were fighting for. He just knew that he was cold. The chill crept up from the road through his thin faux leather boots. He heard something. He spun. Ghosts. Ghosts gliding around the new fallen snow. The men around him fell to the ground. A blossom of red on his khaki shirt. Understanding struck him, then was washed away by pain. He fell backwards. Tried to remember a prayer he'd said a thousand times. He saw booted feet slide by him on skis. The darkness of the forest grew so much darker. He felt very cold, then became very still. The Soviets were unprepared for the war that they had just brought to Finland. Their tanks were olive drab, their uniforms a light brown. Their plan involved sweeping across tracts of land that were, in truth, impenetrable forests broken up by small logging roads. Morale was low, and many of their units were little more than conscripts. And though the Russian winter had prepared them for the cold, none of them had experienced fighting above the Arctic Circle, where the days were dark and the air itself could kill. More than that, though, their leadership had been gutted in 1938. When Stalin purged the army of anyone he thought might be disloyal. Three of the five marshals of the Soviet army were removed, 13 of the 15 army commanders, 8 of the 9 Soviet admirals, 50 of his 57 corps commanders, 154 of the 186 division commanders. A year later, the Soviet military had in no way recovered. The Finns, on the other hand, were a highly mobile force, often mounted on skis and dressed in a white that made them invisible against the winter snow. They were filled with the zeal of people defending their homeland and possessed an intimate knowledge of the terrain. They also had a commander that knew how to use them. Even though they lacked almost any modern tools of war, at times forced to field artillery from the 19th century that still used black powder charges, their commander, Mannerheim, realised that this could be turned into a strength. While Russian armour and artillery confined their forces to the few unreliable roads that travelled the Finnish wilderness, Mannerheim's troops could cross through the forest, allowing them to ambush the Soviets and fade back into the trees. the Finns embarked on a campaign of defence in depth, delaying the Russians every step of the way. Their policy of scorched earth also denied Soviet troops shelter from the cold or extra food foraged from the land. Wherever the enemy was vulnerable, they would swoop in and pick apart Russian infantry divisions with surprise raids, cutting off smaller groups and then destroying them, or letting the winter do it for them. The problem was tanks. The Finnish forces had no weapons capable of disabling enemy armour. At first, they tried harrowing tactics of getting alongside a tank and jamming a piece of lumber or metal into the gears that ran its tread. But soon they discovered something much better. When the war began, the Soviets had bombed major Finnish cities. This outraged nations across the globe. So the Soviet Minister of Foreign Affairs, Vyacheslav Molotov, tried to tell the world that they were dropping relief supplies for the starving Finnish populace. The Finns began to jokingly call the bombs that were dropped on them Molotov bread baskets. Then they decided to give the Russians something back, so they made the Molotov cocktail, the most basic incendiary grenade, a glass bottle filled with a flammable liquid and capped with a rag. Soldiers would light the rag and then throw the bottle. When it broke, the liquid would ignite and spew flames all around. Shattered in the right place, it could disable the engine of an early Soviet tank, or make the inside unlivable by pouring fire and smoke through its many open ports. Russian casualties began to mount, often suffering losses of 5-1 or more. Around the world, people hailed the Finns as heroes. But every day, Mannerheim had an aide read aloud him the names of each Finnish casualty. Despite their stunning success, it was clear they could only hold out for so long. They were running out of food, ammunition, and men. They would not last long without foreign help. The French president offered them 50,000 troops and 100 planes, but he never so much as tried to make this promise a reality. Across the globe, people shouted their support for the Finns, leading many in the country to believe that help would be coming from Britain or America. But the British had no weapons, no troops to spare. They were desperately rearming for their own war. The Americans helped by selling the Finns 30 out-of-date biplanes and demanding cash up front for them from a country they assumed would soon cease to exist. Even the Swedes, who they desperately begged for aid, declined to get involved in the war. Nonetheless, the Finns fought on bravely, defending a loose network of fortifications known as the Mannerheim Line, well into February. But the Soviets continued to reinforce their army and at last broke through. The end was near. The Finnish government had hoped not for a complete victory, but instead to make the invasion so costly that the USSR would have to come to terms. But they did not understand their foe. The mindset of the Soviet Union's high command was different to that of Western democracies. No amount of human sacrifice would make Stalin back down. To him, casualties were a part of war, and any number was acceptable so long as it served the interests of the state. Stalin's terms were shockingly reasonable, though. He simply enforced his demands from the outset of the war and withdrew. But by then the conflict had convinced the rest of the world that the Soviet Union was an empty suit. That despite all their great strength on paper, their forces were actually vastly inferior to what everyone had previously thought. Hitler in particular took it as proof of Soviet weakness, something that would shape his thinking in the years to come. But for all his ruthlessness, as a leader, Stalin had the virtue of learning from his mistakes. He had his generals replaced or shot, encouraged tactics other than just frontal assault, and had his army prepare for winter. Many of the flaws from the Soviet army displayed in the Winter War, from the command staff down, were still there. But the Red Army would never be quite so weak again. April 3rd to June the 10th, Vizerabung. 600 metres. 550. 500. Fire! For a moment his breath catches in his chest. The torpedoes are 40 years old. Antiques from before the First World War. Will they even launch? A silence fills the room. Then he hears it, the telltale sound of a torpedo leaving his tube. Birger Eriksson is 6 months away from retirement. For 7 years, he's commanded the aging naval fortress of Oscarsborg. These days, it's mostly used for training. Nearly all of the troops stationed there hadn't been in the army a week ago. The main guns are two 19th century relics named Moses and Aaron. The fort has only about half of the gunnery crew required to operate them, and its screen of mines is missing. Mining the fjord was supposed to be part of a training exercise scheduled for the next week. But they are all that stands between Norway and invasion. It's the 9th of April, early morning. Reports start to come in that an unknown naval force has forced its way past the outlying fortifications. Eriksson makes a call. Andreas Andersson? Oscarsborg's commander of the torpedo battery is on sick leave. Eriksson needs a replacement. There is only one person that had a chance of making it to the fort in time. Yes, I understand. I'll be right there. He puts on the uniform that's been hanging in his closet for 13 years. He retired over a decade ago. He never thought he'd serve again. But those were his torpedoes. 31 years ago, he'd first come to Oscarsborg. He'd operated those torpedoes as far back as 1909. Today, he would command them one last time. It wasn't long before someone spotted it on the horizon, the massive form of a heavy cruiser. Its stacked guns creating a menacing silhouette in the dawn light. It was the Blücher, one of Germany's most prized warships. Action stations were called. They were desperately short on men. Even the cooks were woken up to help with the ancient guns. The ship loomed larger. Hold! Hold! It was almost on top of them, barely a kilometre and a half away. But Eriksson knew those guns. He knew how long they took to reload and how close the enemy would have to be for them to have a chance of piercing its armour. With their half-trained crew, they'd only ever get one shot. They had to make it count. He ordered the shot. One of the gunners questioned the order. It was Norwegian policy to always fire a warning shot first, and they'd received no order from high command. Eriksson just turned to his men and said, "Either I will be decorated, or I will be court-martialed." Fire! The ancient guns belched flame and smoke. A second passed. Then the roar of impact. Huge gouts of fire coursed into the sky. One of the shells had ripped straight through the Blücher's armoured hull and exploded inside the ship's magazine. Flames spilled out onto the deck. Thick, oily smoke poured from the gaping wound in the ship's side. Ammunition could be heard cooking off from within. And yet the Blücher pressed on. The second shell had scored a lucky hit on its electrical systems, and the main guns couldn't be brought to bear. But it wouldn't matter if they could just get past the fort. The old guns were too slow to reload to fire again. But there, a streak in the water, and another. Andersson had waited until the Blücher was a mere 500 metres away to fire the fort's deadliest weapon. The first torpedo hit the forward section of the ship, minimal damage. But the second hit right on the seam where the first shell landed. Bulkhead after bulkhead ruptured. Water poured into the ship. The upper levels became an inferno, yet the ship pulled away, tried to make it to the shore. The crew desperately attempted to put out the fires. Then, a flash and a series of deafening explosions. The fire had reached the flak ammo storage. A massive hole tore through the steel skin of the ship. She listed. Men leapt off into the freezing waters of the fjord. She began to roll. Oil poured out. Her bows sank. She flipped, then she disappeared below the waves. The tiny crew at Oscarsborg had gotten lucky, but little did they know how lucky they had gotten. The commander in charge of seizing Oslo was on the ship, as were his men. He survived the day, but the sinking of the Blücher brought Norway the precious few hours it so desperately needed for the king and the government to escape. The First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, had been pressing the British government for some time to take action against Germany, to, at the very least, mine the coast of Norway in order to stop vital Swedish iron shipments from getting through. By April the 2nd, he'd finally got the go-ahead for his naval mining operation. As the small flotilla of Royal Navy ships set out to mine the Norwegian coast, they observe elevated levels of German naval activity. But this, the British Naval Command chalked up as either a breakout attempt, a response to the mining fleet, or a preventative measure to keep France and Britain from occupying Norway, an idea they had been toying with since the beginning of the Winter War. But Hitler beat them to the punch. On the 8th of April, just as the Royal Navy was successfully completing its mission, placing mines in the Norwegian fields, German ships were being launched for a full-scale invasion. Within hours, German forces had landed at almost every major port in Norway, and in less than a day, German paratroopers occupied the capital, and the Wehrmacht divisions controlled most of the major cities, not to mention taken over all of Denmark, allowing them to use it as a base of operations for moving further troops into Norway. Surprise was total. The British Admiralty had been so focused on the idea of an attempted German breakout, they entirely missed the fact that the naval activity they'd been observing was actually an invasion fleet. In fact, by deploying the Home Fleet to guard the Atlantic, they put the majority of the Royal Navy forces further away from Norway than it would normally be. Meaning that even after it was clear that an invasion was in progress, they were too far away to do anything, but let it occur largely unopposed. Meanwhile, confusion within the Norwegian government led to further obstacles for mounting a defence. During a midnight session of the cabinet, they ordered a partial mobilisation of the army, without realising that, according to protocol, this sort of partial mobilisation order was to be done without public announcement, and soldiers were to be notified by post, yes, the mail, that they were to meet up with their regiments. Following the meeting on mobilisation, the commander of the Norwegian army went back to his farm to retrieve his toiletries. Why someone else didn't do this for him is a mystery. More of a mystery still is why he didn't go in a staff car. But he didn't, so he ended up at his farm without a uniform on the first day of the war, waiting for a taxi to take him back to his headquarters. When he finally got there, he found that the general staff had already evacuated and no one had remembered to leave transportation for him. So he dutifully walked over to the metro and caught a tram to a rich section of the town to try and find another taxi. He, of course, failed to find one. So he did the next logical thing and walked over to the Norwegian Cartographic Institute to see if maybe they would lend him a car. After some back and forth, it became clear that they didn't have a car for him, so at last, he found that the trains were still running, bought a ticket out of Oslo, and finally rejoined his staff. In fact, it was only due to the heroic action of Norway's naval forts, like the one that destroyed the Blücher, that the conquest of the capital was delayed long enough for the government and the king to escape capture. Unfortunately, that was the only piece of good news for the Norwegians. Much of the initial defence was piecemeal and plagued by confusion. Even when the original commander of the army was sacked, the best the new commander could do in a country with its urban centres overrun and its army only partially mobilised was to fight a delaying campaign until help arrived from the British and French. This, as is becoming a theme, was overpromised and underdelivered. The British largely sent reservists, barely trained and with little to no armoured support, as most of their regular divisions were already deployed to France. The French commitment was equally light, sending a few brigades to a fight when nothing short of a few divisions could make a difference. Moreover, their orders were confused. No real planning had been done for a campaign in Norway, especially for one that was already going so disastrously. Some British officers even resorted to buying travel guides to make up for the fact that they did not have adequate maps. The main Allied effort, though, focused on the northern port of Narvik, the shipping point for Swedish iron heading to Germany. Fighting there was fierce, with Allied forces eventually outnumbering the German garrison of paratroopers, shipwrecked sailors, and light armed mountain troops. But the political will among the Allies failed. In one of the most shameful events of the early war, British troops were ordered to evacuate without telling their Norwegian allies, and, when Narvik was on the verge of being taken, the British withdrew to prepare for battle elsewhere, leaving Norwegians exposed, helpless, and soon to be overrun. And thus, like Poland before it, Norway fell. But what did the Germans truly gain by occupying Norway? Well, first off, they achieved their primary objective of securing a shipping route for Swedish iron ore, allowing German manufacturing to sustain the war effort in a way that it would have been hard-pressed to do if the Swedish iron supply had been cut off. Second, it gained air bases that were invaluable for maintaining control of the Baltic, threatening northern Britain and interdicting shipping heading through the North Atlantic. Something that would come into play if the British ever tried to supply the Soviet Union with war material. But these things came at a cost. Most notably, the Germans had to garrison Norway. Throughout the war, they would leave nearly 300,000 troops to occupy the country and prop up the puppet government they created under Vidkun Quisling, whose name, to this day, is synonymous with traitor. Could these troops have turned the tide in Russia later in the war? Could they have repulsed the Allies landing in Norway? Historians will speculate on this for centuries to come. All that we can say for certain is that these troops were tied up in Norway when they were desperately needed elsewhere. Third, while German ground losses were light, the German surface fleet was badly bruised supporting the campaign. While the initial invasion took the British by surprise, eventually the Royal Navy came to contest the Norwegian coast. And while Allied naval losses were also surprisingly large, they were very much better able to sustain such losses. The Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, already relatively weak outside of its submarine fleet, lost vessels that were functionally irreplaceable by the war-stretched German economy, making serious naval operations, like a future invasion of Britain, practically impossible. Fourthly, Norway never surrendered. Even though fighting on the Norwegian mainland stopped on June the 10th, and the country was occupied, the King and the Parliament were able to set up a government in exile in Britain, meaning not only that the resistance fought on, perhaps more importantly for the long-term war effort, almost all Norwegian commercial shipping escaped and joined the Allied cause, providing the Allies with nearly 1,000 vessels to ferry vital men and material across the globe. In fact, throughout the conflict, the King of Norway acted heroically, refusing to be housed near civilian centres because he didn't want to put his citizens in jeopardy in case the Germans tried to assassinate him with bombers, giving nerve to the Parliament by saying he would abdicate rather than sign an order capitulating to the Nazi regime and staying in the country until it was beyond clear that the Norwegian cause was lost. But perhaps the most important ramification was one that no one could predict, but one whose impact cannot be overstated. On May the 7th, the British Parliament began to debate the conduct of the war in Norway. British news outlets had promised the public great and sweeping victories, yet reality had only yielded confusion, retreat, and defeat. In the pubs, people talked of incompetence and defeatism. There was resentment in the street. The people had lost faith in their government, and the feeling was infectious. And so for 3 days, Parliament debated, and then on the 9th, in a dramatic moment, a vote of no confidence was called. A host of MPs crossed the party line and voted with their country rather than their Prime Minister. On the 10th, Neville Chamberlain resigned. The government of appeasement was gone. In its place came a government led by the fiery Sea Lord, Winston Churchill. This is one of those great inflection points in history where the fate of millions hangs on the actions of a few, on a single decision, or the words of a single human being. Because in the darkest days of the war, there will be many in Britain who argue for a settlement with Germany, for negotiating peace terms with the Third Reich, and withdrawing from the war. And, though we'll never know for certain, given the temperament of the Chamberlain government, it's quite possible that they would have done just that, sued for peace. But Churchill kept the people and the government fighting when things looked their grimmest. Without that, without Britain in the war, who knows how history would have gone? Could the Americans really mount an invasion without the British Isles as a base? Could the Soviets have been adequately supplied in their struggle without British shipping? Would not having to worry about Britain have freed up enough troops for Germany to win the war in the East? The fact that we can even raise those questions shows how momentous this transition was. But no one at the time could have known that. Because on the 10th of May, as Churchill accepted the prime ministership from the king, the world changed. For, as he took office, panzers were pouring out of the Ardennes forest and beginning their headlong race across France. So join us next time for The Fall of France.